You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back, my friends. I guess welcome back to me. Happy Monday. Tom Hartmann here with you. I had to take a couple of days off to attend to a little business here in town, but and thank you to Carl Frisch and to David Sirota for filling in for me. I heard good chunks of both shows, and I thought they did a spectacular job, and thank you for welcoming them. So I am back, and the thing that I think, you know, so is sometimes you want to create a frame about, you know, how to understand a situation or a news story. And I think that sometimes the biggest frame is, what would we be saying about this 20 years from now? Or a decade from now? Or what will the history books be writing about this 100 years from now? And those iconic moments in the 1960s, when African Americans, whether they were trying to cross the bridge or whether it was in Birmingham, when they were blasted with water cannons and the police set dogs upon them and they simply stood their ground or fell to the ground under the force of that assault, which were transmitted across the nation in largely in black and white television. And so I saw this stuff as a little kid. Those iconic moments gave the civil rights movement, which had been given the force of law in 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education decision that essentially reversed Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1898 decision that said that had reversed, in a way, Dred Scott. Dred Scott in 1856 said people are property if they're a certain percentage African-American, and then Plessy versus Ferguson in 1898, as I recall. My apologies if I'm a year or so off on these years, but I'm pretty sure these are right. 1898, just before the 1900s, said, no, they're not property. They're actually people, but they can be kept separate from white people. So you have separate but equal facilities. And then in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court. And again, you know, there's a larger question of why do we have 9 unelected kings making these decisions for us when we're perfectly capable of making these decisions ourselves? We have a democracy in this country, for goodness sakes. But setting that aside, in 1954, the rule of law was established that African Americans had rights in the United States, that the notion of separate but equal was dead. And yet, schools and lunch counters and even cities across America were still segregated year after year after year after year. And the civil rights movement grew up out of that and in opposition to that, saying, no, this is wrong. This isn't how it should be. And a nonviolent movement grew up out of that. And the power of that movement was its nonviolence. And I believe that 20 years from now, we're still going to be seeing the video of that UC Davis, I believe it was the University of California Davis campus, where these young people were sitting on the ground, offering no threat to anybody, simply refusing to move. Just like those young African Americans in the 1950s and 60s. Just saying, I have a right to be here. And this police officer walks up and pulls out his giant bug spray size can of pepper spray, shakes it up a little bit, takes aim like he's about to exterminate some insects. Well, the other police are standing around, and I don't know why they call these damn things batons. They're billy clubs. They're standing around holding their clubs, their billy clubs. And this guy is just calmly walking down the line, just spraying this. This is deadly hot stuff in the eyes of these young people. And they did not jump up and try and knock the can out of his hand. And they did not jump up and try and push him out of the way. And they did not jump up and try and take a swing at him. They sat there. Some of them cried. Some of them screamed. Some of them sobbed. Some of them took it in absolute silence. They sat there. And he worked his way to the end of the line. And then he walked back the other direction. And these were, many of these people were younger than my youngest child. They were, and there were people standing around them who were of the boomer generation as well as of their generation. But their elders, the people in their 40s and 50s and 60s standing around saying, these are young people, these are children, why are you doing this? I believe 20 years from now we're going to be looking back at that moment and say, this was a turning point. That's the power of nonviolence. Meanwhile, you get right-wing talk show hosts. Here's one of the kind of B-level right-wing talk show hosts. I'm not going to name him. On his Facebook profile, he says, just heard on the radio that Egyptian police set occupier tents on fire. Just saying. Like, hey, maybe it's a good idea. You know, maybe what the Egyptians are doing, you know, they're killing people too, right? Maybe what police states do is a good thing. This is a right-wing talk show host. I'm not making this up. Just heard on the radio that Egyptian police set occupier tents on fire. Just saying. And then people respond. I don't think I could get close enough. The smell from Occupy would kill me. Carrick says, yes, I am saying burn down the occupiers' tents. It would be a good thing. And better if they happen to be sleeping in them when they burned. They don't call me a mean man for nothing. John replies, those tents are probably worth money. We could sell them instead. Another says, ha, awesome. U.S. occupiers have been given way too much leniency. Ted Johnson replies, smoke them. Carrick comes back and says, one has to consider the time and money it would take in sanitizing those tents and removing the stench so people could buy them. Obama would see this as economic growth, but he would, because spending more to earn less is the Democratic Party's way. You get this? Just heard on the radio, Egyptian police set occupier tents on fire, just saying. In the meantime, I don't know if you caught the Daily Show last week. David Dayan has a diary about this over at Fire Dog Lake this morning. Liberian woman that won Nobel Peace Prize for occupying Liberia. John Stewart had on as a guest. I didn't see the segment. I heard about it. I'm going to go looking for it afterwards. But Lema Gbaoui, I believe is how it's pronounced. She's a Liberian activist. She won the Nobel Peace Prize this year. What did she do? She occupied a soccer field next door to the Liberian president's office, to the Capitol building, basically, and said, I'm not leaving. She and a bunch of friends, we're not leaving. We're occupying this space until you will have a meeting with us, Charles Taylor. And eventually, this is in Monrovia in Liberia. Liberia, the African country that was invented by the United States during President Monroe's administration, as I recall, thus the name Monrovia, or maybe in memory of it. I don't want to get into the whole history of Liberia. I don't know it that well. But in any case, she refused to leave. They occupied Liberia. For that, she wins a Nobel Prize. People in New York occupy New York. They get beaten and pepper sprayed by billionaire Bloomberg's cops. UC Davis, they get pepper sprayed. I'm telling you, as long as this movement remains nonviolent, this is a turning point in American history.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's one, and it's not an insignificant one. This is going to be a big one. We are changing this country. We are awakening. So as I said, I think this is a pivotal moment. There's a lot of other stuff going on in the news, of course. Violent clashes continue in Egypt. Ironically enough, an anchor on Egyptian television said, We saw the firm stance the U.S. police took against the Occupy Wall Street people. This to justify their shooting people in Tahrir Square, which they're doing on a daily basis now. There may or may not be an election in a week in Egypt for a civilian government. We'll see. Retirement is a bygone luxury. New study by Wells Fargo shows that 75% of senior citizens say that they're going to have to work until they're 80 years old in order to retire. And those people working on the Recall Scott Walker campaign, they're starting to get death threats. Vandalism of their signs. It's amazing. One other thing, quick thing I want to share with you, then I'll pick up some of your calls here. This is from a friend of the show, dropped this note to Louise and I. Actually, a friend of ours who's a friend of the show's, that listens to the show. I went to a small Occupy rally yesterday in Albuquerque, shot some video. About 50 people, mostly women over 60, by the freeway. These women wanted to get a load off their chest. They talked my arm off because I had a camera. I was surprised that the Albuquerque police sent about 10 cars and officers. Then I noticed that there were another 10 guys farther back in military fatigues, BDU fatigues, guns strapped on, etc. It was the SWAT team getting ready. What were they expecting from 50 women over 60 years old? SWAT team assaulted with muffins and pies. Two officers injured by flying coconut cream. Is that it? I mean, it's just incredible, the response. And then you get right-wing talk show hosts saying, just turn on the radio, the Egyptian police set occupier tents on fire. Just saying. Right, yeah, go in and torch some of those people. Let's kill some of these kids. Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Bob in San Luis Obispo. Hey, Bob, thanks for listening to KYNS. What's up?
Yeah, Tom, I opened up the paper this morning, and there's an article here from a couple of L.A. Times authors about how the two officers that were identified in that attack have been placed on indefinite paid leave.
Yes.
And they said only those two because they were the only two who could be identified. Then one of the occupiers himself posted a petition online that has some 30,000 indications of support calling for the chancellor of that particular university's resignation.
Yes, there is an aggressive movement to call for her resignation, for bringing down this police action, for sanctioning it.
And what these right-wingers who are calling for death and mayhem don't understand is that back when I was this age and Kent State happened, it galvanized an entire generation. I mean, I didn't really think about the military when I was that young. Yeah. When Kent State happened, I became very anti-military at that point. And if we have fatalities from SWAT-type militarized police at one of these rallies, it's going to be a backlash. These right-wingers you don't understand.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Thank you, Bob. Thanks for the call. From Bob to Bob in Naperville, Illinois, listening on 92.5 FM. Hey, Bob.
Hey, good morning, Tom. One thing real quick, thank you to you for last week we had our GA with Occupied Naperville, and a lady from Boulder, Colorado, which listens to your show also, heard us, and she happened to be in our area, and she stopped by, gave us some great news about Boulder, Colorado, their Occupied movement, so I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, at Occupied Naperville, we're doing two things right now. We are working on two local issues. One is we've started a food drive that we're working on for the whole month of December. Anybody that in our area that wants to contribute can contribute at the Riverwalk in Naperville down at the amphitheater, noontime every Saturday. And the second thing that we're working on is we're actually going to a protest tomorrow. Our local county government is decided that they're going to get rid of our youth center. Because they said they can't afford it.
The
thing is, Tom, actually in the paper over the weekend, one of the county commissioners that's voting against it on the board actually stated in the paper that because of our success with our juveniles, that's actually hurt us because we're doing such a great job that we don't have as many juveniles in our system.
Right.
And that's the reason why he wants to get rid of it and actually ship it to another county. Right. Where they're going to transport our children from one county to another county that does strip searches, doesn't offer GEDs to the children, where our county does.
Yeah.
We're rated as a five-star.
You know, we used to have some of the very best elementary schools in the world in the United States. We had some of the best middle schools or junior high schools. We had some of the best high schools in the country. We produced a generation, a brilliant generation. And then Reagan came along, put Bill Bennett in charge of the Department of Education, and this whole, well, let's cut the schools thing started. And now we have schools in crisis all over the country. I mean, it is insane what they're doing. Oh, hey, it's successful. Let's cut it. That's the bottom line. Bob, thank you for the call. It's a horrible, horrible story. We have just a minute till the break. David in Springfield, Mass., listening on WHMP. Hey, David, what's up?
Tom, I'd like to talk right to the end. We need a federal law, and it should be pushed by the Democrats, the Republicans, and the unions, that any retail sales outlet, that means a mom-and-pop store, the big department stores, if you have employees exceeding 12 people, you cannot open up on Thanksgiving or Christmas Day. You have to shut down because people should not be forced to work on those days merely because some people want to waste their time shopping and stop employees from having their Christmas or Thanksgiving dinner.
You know, let me tell you something, David. When Louise and I lived in Germany back in 86, they had a federal law, a federal German law, that said on Saturdays and Sundays, as I recall, I think it was both days, certainly on Sundays, that it was illegal to open any store. And the only stores that were open across Germany, I think it was just Sunday, were the gas stations that would have like a 7-Eleven built into them, and people would go there to buy beer and things. But what we found was that people took the day off. They hung out with their families. You'd walk through the forest. There'd be people walking through the forest. It was a good thing. It was really interesting.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So at first, I was like, hey, wait a minute. The government is telling a business owner he can't run his business on a Sunday? And then I thought, wow, the quality of life in this country is really great.
Dirty fat banker sold a house today. Sold at auction once the family out the way. Kicked him on the street because he couldn't pay the tax. Calling an act of God.
Get a million. Welcome dollars. Back to the place where despair is not an option. Get out there, get active, like my cat does. Actually, my cat needs to get more active. He's getting a little more overweight every day. Higgins, our mad attack cat, who literally will attack, fasten himself to somebody if they walk in the door. Anyway, KPOJ, our affiliate in Portland, has a poll up on their morning show part of their site at kpoj.com, 620kpoj.com. There's a link to it off tomhartman.com, as well as it being our poll the day we decided to borrow their poll in honor. You know, there's a link to it. And that is because Liz Smith, the famous gossip columnist, leaked last week, last Friday, I think it was, maybe it was Thursday, that the movie that Leonardo DiCaprio and Warner Brothers are going to make out of a book that Lamar Waldron and I wrote called Legacy of Secrecy about the JFK assassination, that movie is not just going to star Leonardo DiCaprio, but also apparently Robert De Niro. So the question for the clip is, Leonardo DiCaprio will make a movie out of Tom Hartman and Lamar Waldron's book on the JFK assassination, Legacy of Secrecy. Who do you think should have a cameo role in the movie? Tom Hartman, Louise Hartman, or Higgins, the Hartman's cat-slashing, pizza-loving cat?
Yes.
And I went over to the KPOJ site and voted for Higgins. Because you can answer that question at 620kpoj.com or tomhartman.com. And tip of the hat to, I'm guessing Paul Pimentel had something to do with putting that question up. And thank you, Paul and Carl Wolfson. And Paul wants you all to know that he is not related to the guy in New York who the New York police say was going to be a crazed Muslim bomber. And the FBI says, You know, we don't really take this guy that seriously, but New York is getting hysterical about it. I think it's Bloomberg trying to change the topic. Who knows? But anyway. David in Rockford, Illinois, you've got an update on Occupy Rockford?
Yes, hi. How are you, Tom?
I am fine, thank you. Great, but I'll get better.
I hope so. We're going to be, last week at our GA, I had taken your advice that you've been talking about for years to all the people of Occupy Rockford to start becoming elected precinct committeemen and take over the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have shown some interest, and we actually, I got the list. It turns out we have about 70 open seats, so this is
wow.
A good opportunity. Yes, I know. And so we're hopefully going to be able to fill at least
Occupy half of those the Democratic open Party.
Absolutely. And,
I love
you
it.
Know, yeah, well, you've been saying it for years, and, you know, and I'm a precinct committee person myself.
Right.
I had been about 2 months prior to Occupy actually starting, so it made sense, and a lot of people, are accepting that.
Yep.
And we do have some Republicans and, you know, self-proclaimed Republicans and conservatives in our group as well, a couple of them, and we told them take over the Republican
yeah,
Party.
Go occupy the Republican Party, too, and let's eventually occupy Congress with people who are the 99% instead of shills for the 1%.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's great.
And would it be okay if I could plug our official website?
Certainly.
It's www.occupyrockford.org. We're actually having the City Council of Rockford actually just recently, they're going to start tearing down, actually I think they've been tearing down some streetlights in around the Rockford area, but I think about 2,200 of them so far.
Yikes.
And instead of just turning them off and on, you know, with timers, they're just tearing them down, which of course, adds to crime.
Right, and it's going to make it much more expensive to replace them. Are they selling it as scrap or something? Is this is city?
I'm not really sure what they're doing with the scrap of it all. I mean, it's just we're looking to expose it. We're doing a thing this coming Saturday at I think 5 o'clock, and it's going to end at 7 o'clock at night in front of City Hall, where we're going to have a candlelit vigil to go from there and see
That's
what
great.
Happens.
OccupyRockford.com. Yeah.
.com will get us. We'll get anyone there too.
Oh, .org. I'm sorry.
It is .org, but the .com will get you there.
Yeah,
as
it's
well.
Always good to grab both when you can. Okay, David, thank you for the update from Illinois. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Tim in Los Angeles. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I got a question. What should the punishment be for the two officers up in UC Davis? Because, as you know, there was cameras all over the place. And it showed the officer spraying the pepper sprays on the students.
Right.
I have a feeling that what the lieutenant did, I believe his name is John Pike, according to Occupy UC Davis, did what was within policy. But say that they do get punished, either fired or suspended or whatever. Should not then the management who allow this policy to happen be punished too? Because
yes, I think my personal opinion, and please let me put a huge caveat on this by saying I wasn't there. I'm not
right.
This is just the opinion of an outraged citizen, right? This is not an informed opinion, and I may well be wrong, and evidence may come forward that completely causes me to change my mind. But my gut instinct is to say that the chancellor should be fired. For authorizing this, that the chief of police should be fired for having a police department that is this out of control, and that the two officers who were shooting the pepper spray should not only be fired but should also be charged with criminal assault.
Right.
And that's
so everyone should be punished.
That to me looks like criminal. That's the same as walking up to somebody in the street and shooting pepper spray at them if they're not committing a crime or if these people were committing a small crime. You know, misdemeanor of sitting there, that's like walking up to somebody who's jaywalking and pepper spraying them. And I just don't think that any police officer or anybody else should have the right to do that. So that's, Tim, that's what I would be doing. Or that would be my recommendation. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Good morning, Tom Hartman. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, Gary. In fact, it's afternoon for both you and me. What's up?
Yeah, it is. Just the spur of the moment, I wanted to call you and say a few words about assembly, our right to assembly. It just seems to me that over 45 years ago, a man we all know called Martin Luther King, he was very persistent about assembly and speaking out and very, very persistent. And it just seems to me one of the best ways we can honor his legacy and preserve what I think is a declining democracy, unfortunately. Doesn't have to be declining. We can turn it around. We can turn this around. Is to continue to put a face on the right to assemble.
Right. And that's what the Occupy movement is doing, is people showing up and saying, hey, I'm here and I'm not going away and I am participating. Thank you very much, Gary. Very well said. Joe in Portland. Hey, Joe.
Well, Tom, I wish to thank you for everything you do. I listen to you regularly. I wanted to comment on your opening comments this morning, civil disobedience. I hear a lot of people go back to Gandhi or to Martin Luther King on that idea, but we have two classic 19th century American writers that are sometimes overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
Henry David Thoreau, author of Walden, and his essay on the duty of civil disobedience.
Yes.
Has the line in there, under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the place for a just man is in prison.
Yes. And in fact, Thoreau himself went to prison for that reason.
Yes, he did. War against Mexico, he was protesting.
Yes.
But even older than that is perhaps our greatest writer, Herman Melville. And he wrote a haunting novella called Bartleby the Scrivener. People don't often see it, but the subtitle of that was A Story of Wall Street. And Bartleby, of course, is the haunting scrivener who's about gone blind from being a copying machine for his employer most of his life, stands looking out the window at the dead blind wall across the alley, as Melville puts it. And everything that the employer and attorney offers him, Bartleby says, I would prefer not. I would prefer not. That's his answer. And it's just a hauntingly beautiful story.
I've heard of it, Joe. I've never read it. I've tried to read Moby Dick once and got about 30 pages into it. But it's a short one. I'll have to track it down. Joe, thank you for the tip on that. Bartleby, is it Bartleby as in Bartleby's, Bartleby?
Yes, Bartleby the Scrivener.
Great. I'll check it out. Joe, thank you very much for the call. Carol in Charlottesville, Virginia. A minute to the break. Carol, what's up?
Hi. On the UC Davis, I don't know if you saw the TV clips, but the students were waiting for the chancellor to leave her office.
Mm-hmm.
And as she did, they lined both sides of the streets where she had to walk two blocks to her car.
Yes.
And they did it in perfect silence.
Yes.
Not a word. And the look on her face, she was so scared. I mean, it was just the marvelous thing to see. You talk about not making a sound. Those students didn't make one peep.
Yeah, that's moral force. That's like the women in black, I believe they called themselves, or perhaps it was the women in white, who, as we started the Iraq War, and they continued doing this for several years, and in fact, I went out and met them in a couple of different cities, and they would occasionally be holding flowers, and they'd hand you a flower, but they never said a word. They just stood there. And it was this, and this is something that went back to the 18th century, to the 19th century, as a protest against various wars, from the Civil War and also the women's rights movement. Carol, thank you for sharing that. That was an important one, too.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Let's check in with John Nichols, The Nation Magazine, see what's going on with Scott Walker. I understand the Lieutenant General Lieutenant Governor is screaming.
Madison, well, this is for the people in Madison. We believe in you, Madison. Don't give up the fight in Madison.
Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program, and John Nichols with The Nation, the Washington reporter for TheNation.com, and resident of Madison, Wisconsin, on the line. Hey, John, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be with you, Tom. And, you know, when you said this is where smart people get the news, I was reminded of Paul Krugman's reference to Newt Gingrich as what dumb people think a smart person would say.
that's great.
Oh, you're what smart people think a smart person would
say. Bless you, sir. I saw a video not just 10 minutes ago of the lieutenant governor of the great state of Wisconsin saying, Please don't sign one of those petitions, because if you do, it'll cost the state $7.4 million, which we could use for other things.
Yeah, have
they really,
are they really
stooping that low? Like she's like, you know, if you don't sign the petition and you leave me and Scott Walker in power, then we'll give you free health care?
Well, this is a fascinating thing. Suddenly, Walker and Klesisch, his lieutenant governor, have gone socialist. It's fabulous. It's sort of a reclaiming of the Wisconsin socialist tradition. Both the governor and the lieutenant governor, in advertising, on TV, as well as videos and all sorts of other vehicles, are talking about how they want to provide health care for the poor and more education and all sorts of wonderful things.
That they
and
just
the only
can't.
The thing that will stop them is the recall.
Right, because the recall is going to cost the state $7 million.
Which is, by the way, not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
The actual cost of the state is around $600,000, and the cost to communities, it depends on when the election is scheduled and a host of other issues. Most people who run elections in this state are, essentially volunteers.
Right.
So it's very inflated. And, the other thing, I can tell you something. Here's a fascinating little factoid for you. If you want to reduce the cost of the recall, when a sufficient number of signatures are filed, Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Klesisch choose not to mount multi-million dollar legal challenges to the recall if they accept that, 700,000-800,000 people would like to have a new election. That will save millions.
Yeah.
It will save the taxpayers millions of dollars.
Yeah. Yeah, and
so if
and
they're
if,
really concerned, I got some suggestions.
Yeah, and if the sun doesn't rise tomorrow,
I know.
Hell freezing over, snowballs. All right, it's
ice skating. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm also hearing some disturbing reports that people who are visibly involved in the recall Scott Walker campaign in Wisconsin are getting literally death threats. I thought that was something that was largely reserved for talk show hosts.
Well, mind you, talk show hosts are probably more deserving.
John.
Not all of them.
I don't think any of them, frankly. But again, having been the regular recipient of them, I'll tell you, I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
Tom, you're a big kid. You and Rush Limbaugh are big kids. Somebody gets through to you and threatens you. You, A, know how to assess it. B, know how to handle it. And see, know how to respond to it.
Yeah.
When you call...
And I've got the FBI on speed dial.
Right. But when you call a teacher or a snowplow driver or, somebody who may not even have been active in politics a year ago and make threats to them, and when that call comes not from a fellow Wisconsinite, but it's called in from another state, so you understand that what's happened is folks who have volunteered to be local coordinators in small towns, crossroads towns in Wisconsin, say, I want to be a volunteer. I want to step up and help to get my state back. And they give their phone number out so others in the neighborhood or others in the community can call. There's folks in other states going online, finding those numbers, calling and threatening those people. And that's not like calling you, Tom. That's not like calling Rush Limbaugh. That is calling somebody who's, a citizen beginning to engage in this process and trying to scare them away from it, trying to threaten them out of it. It is really the darkest side of this. But I do want to emphasize something that I think is very important. While that has occurred, and while there have been a couple of incidents of people ripping petitions out of hand, I don't want to create a false impression for your listeners. The reality is that across Wisconsin, including in the most militantly Republican and conservative areas, people are out with their petitions. Right before I took your call, I was in Burlington, Wisconsin. Burlington is a town that voted for Richard Nixon, for Ronald Reagan, for George Bush the dad, George Bush the son, and for John McCain. It is a Republican town. And on the corner across from the charcoal grill and rotisserie in the parking lot is somebody who's opened up the back of their van, and they have a big banner up that says, sign recall petitions here, and there were a whole bunch of cars and SUVs parked around the van with folks sitting in the car signing. That's in Burlington, Wisconsin, right now, this morning.
And that person is not working for the Republican Party and planning on destroying the petitions.
No, no, I could tell that I could tell the car didn't have that Republican finish on it.
Okay.
But what I want to tell you is this is an important thing to do.
Yeah.
While it is true there have been some threats, there has been some intimidation, it is much more important to recognize that in every corner of Wisconsin, people are doing this, and they are getting very positive responses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we don't dismiss the intimidation, but we also recognize the much broader reality that this is working. They have collected more than, in the first 4 days, they collected 105,000 signatures. And that doesn't begin to tell you everything because most haven't been turned in yet.
Yeah.
And so this thing is really happening.
Yeah. It's, and there's still, how many days to go? Isn't it a 60-day window?
Yeah, right now they've got 54 days to go.
And they're already 20% of the way there, almost?
Yeah, and I want to emphasize, Tom, that is just the beginning of a measure of it.
Yeah.
They've got to go well over 540,000, the
sure.
official number.
Sure.
Probably around 700,000, 800,000, maybe
yeah.
more.
Well, probably like Ohio, you'll end up with 1 million, that'd be my guess.
So, but I can tell you, towns around the state, there are many towns that are already getting at least halfway or more to their goal.
Wow, incredible. John Nichols, thenation.com. John, keep up the great work and the great reporting, and thanks for putting things in perspective for us. It's truly appreciated.
And Tom, yeah. People in Wisconsin really value your report. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. In our first hour, we've been going through everything from right-wing talk show hosts saying that...
Just heard on the radio that Egyptian police set occupier tents on fire. Just saying,
yeah, let's burn them out. To what's going on in Wisconsin. Death threats against people pulling together petitions. It's really quite remarkable. And, of course, the 13th member of the supercommittee, Grover Norquist. But most of our conversation was about whether the UC police officers should be fired and charged with criminal assault and whether the chancellor and the chief of police at the University of California, Davis campus should be fired. And I am in favor of all of the above. J.A. Meyerson is with us. JAMeyerson.com is his blog, his website. Contributed to Truthout and a participant in the Occupy Wall Street movement. J.A., welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So just give us an update. You know, here it's Monday. What's been going on over the weekend? What do we need to know about?
Well, you need to know that Duarte Square, which is a lot owned in part by the city and in part by Trinity Church, which sits on Canal Street and 6th Avenue, is the new home of Occupy Wall Street, having been evicted from Liberty Plaza Park, and they're reconstituting the occupation up there. This after our massive show of support, 35,000 people marching, and that's a low-ball estimate, in downtown Manhattan on Thursday, and many people, including yours truly, going to jail for civil disobedience.
Okay. So, and this park is being occupied. Is this in part because the church gave permission for that?
The church is sympathetic to the occupation. There are sort of ongoing negotiations about trying to make sure this is a permitted thing, but part of the fact of occupation is essentially not caring whether it's permitted. I mean, Mohammed Bouazizi's fruit stand was not permitted.
Right. My permit is the First Amendment.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Forgive my interruption. My permit is the First Amendment.
Yes, exactly, right. And the First Amendment does not have a curfew.
Right.
You know, the occupation of Tahrir Square was not permitted. And once you have, you know, big-time revolutions that achieve justice and equality for a lot of people, nobody then frets and moans over the legality of the occupation that started it.
Right. And they are never permitted. Let's just be blunt about it.
The American Revolution was not permitted, and the you know, the dissent against the Soviet Union was not permitted, and you know, social justice is not permitted. That's why protesters were dragged out of Woolworth's lunch counters, because they were not permitted to be there.
Right. The Bonus Army was not permitted in 1932 on the banks of the Potomac River here.
But you know what else isn't permitted? Pepper spraying kids in the face at point blank range when they're just sitting there peaceably blocking a pass. You know, Gingrich's plan for janitorial work for students is an awful lot better than coughing up blood because you've just been the victim of really casual chemical weaponry. I mean, that's how Josh Holland put it, our friend from Alternate, that this was a use of very casual chemical weapons against peaceably protesting students, and that's also not permitted. And you know, for these folks to be on paid leave as opposed to fired from UC Davis is an outrage.
Oh, for them to be on paid leave as opposed to being sitting in a jail cell with an assault charge is an outrage.
Absolutely, it's clear assault.
And you know, assault can be committed by people in uniform just as easily as it can be committed by you know, anybody else. I mean, the laws do not say, you know, you can commit assault, you know, simple assault or aggravated assault or whatever you want to call it, that you can do that if you happen to be a police officer. And in fact, frankly, I would say the bar should be higher for a police officer than for somebody who's drunk in a bar fight.
Absolutely. And our friend Ray Kelly, the former police captain from Philadelphia, who's now protesting with Occupy Wall Street and going to jail, committing civil disobedience, says that the only circumstance under which police should be permitted to use force is when protecting someone. And Lieutenant Pike in Davis was not protecting anyone. I have to say that I did watch the chancellor's interview with student television and was convinced that she's actually quite reasonable and considered on this matter. But it still demands that she fire Lieutenant Pike, at least, and the other officer who committed that assault.
At the very least. You yourself were reported, Alternate Sarah Jaffe reported, that the crowd let out a big cheer as Truth Out contributor J.A. Meyerson was arrested. What were the circumstances of your arrest, Jay?
Well, I was not arrested reporting, and I wasn't wearing credentials, and I wouldn't have hid behind them. I was protesting, committing an act of civil disobedience in response to many of my comrade journalists being arrested during the raid, including journalists from the Daily News and the New York Post and all sorts of rags that are sympathetic to Bloomberg. These folks were put in jail in violation of the First Amendment, which specifically prohibits government abridgment of the freedom of the press. And so I felt that it was my duty to offer my body for arrest in solidarity with my fellow journalists. I sat in an intersection along with many friends from the occupation and was carted off to jail, which was awful and uncomfortable and sucked, but I was only in there for a day. And there are a lot of people who go to prison, which is an awful lot worse than jail. And sometimes, like in the case of Troy Davis, they haven't done anything and we lock them up in prison for 20 years and then we kill them. Right. So ultimately, prison was, or jail was bad, but, you know, the historical perspective, really, really helps get you through it. A lot of people went to jail a lot of times between the Montgomery bus boycott of 55 and achieving voting rights and civil rights acts in 67 and 68. So I'm happy to go to jail. In 6 months, my record will be clean. There will be no record of the arrest. And in 6 months and a day, you can expect to see me in jail again.
Okay. And this also raises the question of journalism in America and journalists as gatekeepers of, quote, the news. You know, in the early years of this republic, there were not journalism schools and anybody could open a newspaper. And in fact, that newspaper very often was just a single piece of paper that was printed at a local printer, you know, sometimes with charity or whatever. I mean, the definition of what was a journalist was very, very vague. And then we went through a period of time where the definition of journalist got very, very tightened up to where it was, oh, you apply for press credentials and you're with a major network and all this kind of nonsense. And now I think with the internet, we're back to the era where you could be a journalist in the 1700s simply by, you know, nailing a piece of paper to a tree. And now, of course, you nail it to the internet. And it seems
right.
to me.
I, 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 I forget the wit who said that there's freedom of the press for anyone who can afford one, but now everyone can afford one.
That's right. Yeah, and that was the famous quote from wasn't it William Randall Hearst or somebody like that, but
it might have been Hearst.
Whatever it was. In any case, it seems to me that the First Amendment, which is the only place in the entire Constitution where an industry is mentioned, and that industry, of course, being the press, the founders didn't find it necessary to protect defense contractors, for example, even though you could argue that without weaponry you can't fight a war. They didn't feel that it was necessary to protect pretty much anything else. But they protected the press and they protected the right to assemble in the same place. I would say that the people sitting there who are twittering are the press as much as the press is. And
I agree. I mean,
15
that,
seconds
and,
here.
And that a hallmark of any good democratic society is special dispensation made for the press. I mean, that was one of the things that was so outlandish about Egypt during the revolution was that they evicted Al Jazeera and they shut down the internet, and that meant that people just gathered in the square to get their news, which was, you know, really wonderful. And during that, we had every person in American foreign policy, including the president himself, condemning the use of authoritarian violence to crack down on dissent and on the universal human rights of peaceable assembly. And we sort of don't hear...
J.A., hold on just a second.
Amendment is being bridged.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're absolutely right. And J.A. Meyerson, jamyerson.com. Thanks so much for being with us today, J.A.
Thank you.
Good speaking with you.
You cannot win. You may throw me down, but I'll...
Okay, let me just bring you up to date. Welcome back to Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, and a variety of you need to know this is the Gang of 12 in Congress, the Super Committee, almost certainly down in flames. And frankly, in my opinion, when John Boehner put together this deal with Barack Obama, and then later, you've probably seen the video of him leaning back going, yeah, well, here, clip three.
And when you look at this final agreement that we came to with the White House, you know, I got 98% of what I wanted. I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, okay, so what did he want? Well, what he wanted was he wanted these huge cuts in defense programs and these huge cuts in social programs, in the social safety net, that will throw more and more people into poverty and further depress the economy. Because people won't have money to buy things, and 70% of our economy is people buying things. It's a consumer economy. He wanted those cuts, and he wanted to have the super committee that would prevent the cuts from defense from happening and could maybe raise some taxes. But the super committee is going to fail, and I am personally of the opinion that Boehner put this thing together intending for it to fail, that the Republicans never had any good, honorable intent going into this thing. And that once it fails and the cuts are supposed to automatically happen, now, first of all, they don't automatically happen for another year and 2 months. They don't automatically happen until January 2013. So there's plenty of time for Congress to do things, and this is going to become very political. This is my prediction. I may be totally wrong on this, but my prediction is, A, the super committee will fail. B, Congress is then looking at having to do the sequestration thing of cutting, you know, $500 billion out of the defense budget, $500 billion or more out of the, you know, 0.6, 0.7, out of social programs. The Republicans will mount a campaign. It will be on all the Sunday talk shows. It'll be on right-wing talk radio. It'll be wall-to-wall on Fox News. It will be in letters to the editor of the newspapers. It will be in television ads saying, what, defense cuts? When we're in the middle of two wars and Iran might be getting a nuclear weapon and South Korea's behaving like a whack-a-mole and China is, and but quack, 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 quack. Defense cuts? We can't have defense cuts. And, you know, really what they're saying, these Republicans, is these guys, you know, that guy living down the street here in Alexandria in the 34-room mansion with the attached servants' quarters, who's shoveling, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars into Congressman Q's campaign. We can't offend that person. We can't cut off their money supply. Because make no bones about it, this is not about the defense of the United States. It's not even about the military. It's not even about our troops. It's about the contractors. But in any case, they will launch this huge campaign, and the strategy is very, very simple. They're going to say, we need to pass legislation that undoes the automatic trigger that cuts defense. They have a year to do it, which means that they can take it right up to the election, which means they can drag this thing out. It may be 6 months before you see them do what I'm telling you right now. But you will remember my telling you this. They're going to say, we've got to undo that legislation that cuts defense because we can't have the defense of the America, the United States of America cut. The Republicans. And they're going to say, and the Democrats, they want to cut defense. They want to close military bases. They want to bring troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan. They don't want a bomber. They're weak on defense. The Democratic Party that won World War I, that won World War II, that won the Korean War, or at least stalemated it. The Democratic Party, they're lousy on defense, right? Where did this insanity come from? But that's what they're going to say. And the Democrats, particularly in the Senate, who are up for re-election, are going to start quaking in their boots. They're going to be going, they're going to be saying to themselves, oh my God, if I don't vote to go along with eliminating the defense cuts, the automatic defense cuts, and which is, of course, is going to mean cut more out of food stamps, cut more out of, support to education, cut more out of the national parks, cut more out of NASA, forget about deep space exploration, forget about the Hubble telescope. I mean, you know, fill in the blank. The Democrats are just going to be visualizing the campaign ads that are going to run in November of next year that say, did you know that Democratic Senator so-and-so voted to cut troops to our soldiers just when they were in their greatest time of need and right in front of the enemy? The enemy is going to get them because these Democrats cut. That's what's going to happen. And mark my words, the Democrats will cave on this. Because if they don't, the Republicans will eat their lunch in the elections. Now, I'm not saying they should. I'm just telling you political calculus 101. It's been going on ever since Dwight Eisenhower warned us about it in 1961. In fact, it had been going on for two decades before that. I mean, back when Abraham Lincoln in the 1840s was, congressman in Illinois yelling about the Mexican-American War, it was possible for a politician to speak out against wars. But not anymore. Should be, but it ain't. So this is what you're going to see. John Boehner is going to get 98% of what he wanted. And what he wanted is a very unique kind of America. Newt Gingrich described it over the weekend in some very elegant terms that I'm going to share with you right after the break that I think will make your hair stand on end. We'll pick up some of your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And back with, are the child labor laws really stupid? Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's just amazing what's going on here. Newt Gingrich is now the leading candidate on the Republican side for president of the United States. The guy who married his high school teacher, his high school history teacher, I think she was, or math teacher, whatever. He was her high school student. And then divorced her when she got cancer and married the woman that he was having an affair with, who I think worked in his office. and then divorced her and married the woman that he was having an affair with her, who is now has this million-dollar Tiffany line of credit, and who has gone from being a middle-class congressman with a decent salary, 100 and something thousand bucks a year, to a multimillionaire, in part by taking $300,000 from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac back during the height of the housing bubble, helping them hype mortgages, providing strategic consulting. Right. I think it's called lobbying. Anyhow, he has a solution to the nation's problems. You know, in 1900, about a quarter of the workforce in the United States was under 15 years old. About 10% of it was under 12 years old. Congress tried to pass a law in 1918, that made child labor illegal. The Supreme Court struck it down. It ultimately got passed again in the 1930s and has been the law of the land ever since. There are obviously exceptions. I remember when I was 15 years old, I wanted to get a job at Henry's Hamburgers. So I had to get what was called a work permit. I had to get my parents' permission, and the city issued this work permit that got around the child labor laws so that I could flip hamburgers at Henry's Hamburgers for $1.35 an hour or whatever it was back then. But Newt doesn't want to do that. He says, you know, if you're a student, if you're rich, after you take your classes, you should study. But if you're a student and you're poor, after you take your classes, you should clean the restrooms. I'm not making this up. Here he is.
Core policies of protecting unionization and bureaucratization against children in the poorest neighborhoods, crippling them by putting them in schools that fail, has done more to create income inequality in the United States than any other single policy.
Except the Bush tax cuts.
It is tragic what we do in the poorest neighborhoods in trapping children in, first of all, in child laws, which are truly stupid. Okay, you say to somebody, you shouldn't go to work before you're what, 14, 16 years of age. Fine. You're totally poor. You're in a school that is failing with a teacher that's failing.
Because Reagan cut the funding.
Most of these schools ought to get rid of the unionized janitors, have one master janitor, and pay local students to take care of the school.
Oh, brilliant.
The kids would actually do work. They would have cash. They'd have pride in the schools. They'd begin the process of rising. Get any job that teaches you to show up on Monday. Get any job that teaches you to stay all day, even if you're having a fight with your girlfriend. You're going to see from me extraordinarily radical proposals to fundamentally change the culture of poverty in America and to give people a chance to rise very rapidly.
Yeah, stay all day. Work your butt off. No, you don't have to study. You're poor, right? In Newt's world, the poor don't study. They work. He wants to return us to the 19th century. He doesn't just want to take us back to, you know, the golden age of Reagan. He wants or the golden age of Eisenhower, or the golden age of Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. He wants to take us back to the golden age of Ulysses S. Grant or Zachary Taylor. It's just mind-boggling. What his next proposal is going to be, you know, lower the age of consent to 12 like it used to be also. I mean, what is with this guy? Children should be working instead of going to school because he and his party have cut the funding to their schools to the point that our schools are just a shadow of what they were 30 years ago. Fire the janitors and put the kids in their place? Because their parents are poor? Oh, sorry, kid. You weren't a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. Your daddy wasn't a millionaire. He wasn't one of Newt's donors. Do you get how bizarre this is? And this is mainstream Republican thinking right now. This is Michelle Bachmann saying, look at China. They don't have a welfare state. They don't have free health care. They don't have Social Security. And look at how fast they're growing. We should be just like that. They're growing because of their trade policy. maybe we should consider having a trade policy instead of outsourcing it to the transnational corporations that run the World Trade Organization? Something China has not done? How can the average American listen to this and not go, these people are crazy? Or maybe the average American just isn't paying attention yet. I've said it many, many times. I'll say it again. Independent voters, there are some people who are independent voters for very rational, very well-informed reasons. Bernie Sanders is an independent politician for those kinds of reasons. But the vast majority of the people who call themselves independents, what they're really saying is they'd rather watch football. They'd rather watch, you know, the Real Housewives of New Jersey or whatever it is. They'd rather listen to fill in the blank, you know, music. They don't know what's going on. And the way that they're going to inform themselves about politics is 2 weeks before the election, they're going to start noticing the commercials that are on during their favorite TV show. They don't have a friggin' clue. And those people swing elections in this country. They determine elections. And so you get these very, very cynical, you know, like the lieutenant governor of Wisconsin saying, lying. Please don't sign those petitions to recall me because it's going to cost the state $7 million. It's just, which we'd like to use to help people in need. Oh, really? It just blows my mind. I don't know how to go beyond that. Dean in L.A. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hey, good morning. Yeah, no surprise that we get people in office who don't do anything like we expected on our behalf.
Yeah, because nobody's paying attention, or not enough people are paying attention.
You hit the nail on the head. I get myself educated. I mean, I'm very lit up about the Occupy movement. And, you know, it drove me to read up because I'd hear people comment like, well, you know, the Tea Party was an expression of anger by the people. And, the Occupy is as well. But, you know, I went and I read up on what, you know, the Tea Party likes to claim is the base of what their argument was came from the Boston Tea Party. At least that was their, the source of their name. But when I read about what happened at the Boston Tea Party, I kind of went, oh, my God, everything about what the Tea Party seems to stand for is contrary to what
I think I wrote the first really good summary of that. I actually found an original, the one original book written by the one person who was at the Boston Tea Party who survived long enough to pass the 50-year oath of silence they all took and write it down in a book, which is John Robert Twelvetree Hughes. And his book about the Boston Tea Party, and I excerpt from it at length in my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and What We Can Do About It. And, in fact, the Boston Tea Party was a response to the Tea Act of 1773, which was not an increase in taxes. It was a tax cut. It was a huge tax cut for the British East India Company, which was the Walmart of its day, and it would have allowed them to undersell the small local merchants and put them out of business, which was the plan, and that's what it was all about. Dean, you're absolutely right. Thank you for the call. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. Hey, Walter, what's up? Walter? You got to listen to your phone, not your radio or TV. Larry in Kalmar, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Join Free Speech TV.
Oh, thank you.
I'll send in my $10 here soon.
Great. So what's up?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, who do you see as heroes coming out of the Occupy movement? I mean, we've had our heroes like Bernie and Amy and Greg Plath, Mike Farrell and Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
These two injured Marines that, you know, I see them as.
Well, right now you've got Scott Olson, one of those two injured Marines. I think that that movements evolve and individuals become the faces of movements because as human beings we're wired for story, and part of story is, you know, having somebody that we can identify with, an individual. But for you and me right now, I think that we need to view the entire Occupy Wall Street movement, the entire 99% movement, collectively as a hero. And then, you know, yeah, it will emerge. I'm in no hurry to see an individual, you know, the modern day Martin Luther King stand up right and say, "Hi, I'm me, I'm here." I think that the times define the person, not the other way around. And, you know, people will come forward. This retired police officer who got arrested in New York, for example. People will come forward. We'll see.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service in just a minute and also more of your calls. Stick around. 45 minutes past. We dedicate this to Newt Gingrich, who wants children to go back to work instead of going to school. Or if they do go to school, he wants them to clean the bathrooms afterwards instead of studying, because after all, you know, poor kids, they don't need time to do homework. It wouldn't matter anyway, right? They're poor. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, Ellen Ratner's personal charity to help save people in southern Sudan. And Victoria, I see you're at the White House today.
I am indeed, yes. I've just come from the White House press briefing with Jay Carney.
Mm-hmm. So what's up?
Well, a lot of things are up, including, of course, the super committee super fail. Well, almost. We're waiting, but we won't get any announcement until after the markets close, because the nervous Nellies on the market have already reacted to something that any of them who were analysts could have predicted some months ago, but apparently didn't figure out until today. But, yes, we are expecting an announcement, and it's possible that it will be on camera. It's also possible, and this is an example of how squabbling they've got to, that because they can't even agree on how to do that it will be a written announcement.
Right, because everybody wants to point fingers and mutter about the other. Now, exactly. What I was saying back when this thing first happened, and John Boehner said, and Jacob, you've got that clip, it's only 7 seconds. This is what John Boehner said when this train wreck that's happening right now is put into place.
And when you look at this final agreement that we came to with the White House, you know, I got 98% of what I wanted. I'm pretty happy.
Now, what, in my opinion, what he wanted was big defense cuts, big domestic cuts. Then you have the super committee. It falls apart. And then the Republicans begin campaigning on, let's do away with the defense cuts part of that, because after all, we can't hurt our military, particularly you don't want to defund the troops while they're in harm's way. And all the Democrats will have to go along with that because they don't want to get, you know, trashed in the election cycle with ads that say you voted against the troops. And then John Boehner ends up with no tax cuts whatsoever and massive cuts for social services and funding of those kinds of things, which is exact 98% of what he wanted. He was playing chess, three moves ahead, and the Democrats have been playing checkers, one move ahead. Do you think I'm crazy?
I don't think you're necessarily entirely sane.
I'm not entirely sane?
Not necessarily this time.
Really?
No, not necessarily. I think the super committee, Democrats, for Democrats, played it quite well. You didn't see any defections by Max Baucus.
Right.
They found that the Republicans were utterly intransigent on taxes.
No, that's my point. What I'm saying is that Boehner knew that the super committee was going to fail because
right.
his Republican buddies were going to make it fail.
Right. Right. But I'm not sure that this time that Democrats will go along with that. I think that they're looking at the same polls that you're looking at. I think they're seeing that Americans, including independents in the country, are in favor of some tax increases as well as cuts. And so I think that they will feel the wind at their back in 2012 and may be resistant, particularly since the cuts that the Pentagon is talking about are not necessarily to big missiles and things. They're talking about pensions of soldiers.
Oh, geez. That's wonderful. Yeah, let's cut our soldiers' pensions.
That's the kind of thing that they've been talking about.
But Leon Panetta has
billion from that.
Leon Panetta has, you know, the new Secretary of Defense has already said, if you cut, you're going to cut bone. You know, it's I forget his exact phrase. You probably know it.
Well, they've also talked about how they've got quite a lot of rubbish at the Pentagon as well. There's an excellent piece on Mother Jones, by the way, about what they're going to cut at the Pentagon, which I would refer you to.
Fascinating. Well, Victoria, thank you for informing me about that. I hope that you are right and my rather cynical appraisal of this is totally wrong.
Well, I think you may be partially right. It depends. You know, the Democrats, I think, got a bit of a spine, and I think it depends whether they're able to keep it next year. I think it also depends whether they're able, as a group, which they haven't been able to, because I always describe them as cats, to remain in lockstep and stay on talking points together next year and campaign as a group. Yeah. I think that's going to be very important for them.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to watch, particularly as we get into September, October.
Yes, vital.
So what else is up?
Events in Egypt today, 33 people now reported to have been killed in the violence over the past 3 days.
Oh, my.
Yeah, Ministry of Health saying more than 1,500 have been injured in the latest clashes in and around Tahrir Square. They are planning, the Revolutionary Youth Movement has called for a 1 million-man march in the capital and across the country tomorrow. And crowds in Tahrir Square have been growing and clashes continuing as night's fallen in the Egyptian capital. Elections should go ahead as planned at the end of this month. So that's basically in a week now.
Now, if those elections happen,
yes,
will there be a civilian government that comes out of that that can control the military? Or is it going to keep intact essentially a status quo?
Any civilian government that comes into place won't be in power immediately. The military seems to have set it up in such a way, and it's very complicated from what I've seen, in such a way that they don't take power immediately. They've also set it up that they have an enormous amount of control over the way the constitution's written, also that they get to pick the prime minister and do all number of things that ensures that they keep control. And they want to keep control because they've got their fingers in so many pies. They right. control bottled water. They own land. They own businesses. They make so much money.
Yeah, it's an industry. And then this is why the founders of this country wanted to make sure that the military was always under civilian control. And one of the Republican candidates last week said it's a good idea to put the military to take it away from civilian control. Was that Herman Cain? Which one was that?
I'm not sure which one that was.
Oh, it was Rick Perry.
It was Rick Perry. There you go. Yeah.
That's
fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Let's have a military just like Egypt's. Okay, 30 seconds. Any other?
Yes, the FBI on more than one occasion declined to pursue the New York City bomb plot, apparently feeling that he was mentally unstable and incapable of pulling it off, two law enforcement officials said today.
So is Mayor Bloomberg just hyping this thing?
It's starting to look as though that may be the case.
Surprise, surprise. Well, it does change the conversation away from his bad treatment of the occupied folks. So.
And that orange sweater.
Yes. Let's not go there. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Stick around. Sarah Vandegeller is going to be here with us about the Occupy movement.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. What is the Occupy Movement? What is the significance of the Occupy Movement? Where is the Occupy Movement going? What's the Occupy Movement up to? How is it going to change everything? How has it already changed everything? Many of the questions asked and attempts to answer. I don't think that any of us will know the answers to any of these things until maybe 20, 30, 40 years from now, retrospectively, but certainly, this is a great attempt. A new book called This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99% Movement, published by BK Publishers. Sarah Vandegeller, who is also the co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine, is the editor of the book. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. Through the book and through the eyes of the various people who have contributed to this book, I'm curious what, you know, I threw a bunch of questions out there. Pick one or two and give me your thoughts on it. What is this? Where is it going? What's up?
Well, let's start with what has already changed. You know, I think one of the things that it's useful to think about is that even if nothing else was to happen, it's already changed the nature of our political dialogue. I don't think you can any longer run for office or talk about major policy proposals without there being in the background the question, does this help the 1% or does this help the 99%? So I think we've been trying to paper over that, or the political establishment has for a long time, and now that's no longer going to be possible. I think the amazing turnout for the Move Your Money Day is just one example of that. I mean, that went far beyond the sort of normal activist world. There were 650,000 new accounts created at credit unions just in the month of October, and billions of dollars transferred. So I think people are starting to realize, you know, those big banks, those big Wall Street banks are not our friends. We need to be working with our local economy, our local credit unions, and that's the kind of thing that we're talking about in the book, This Changes Everything.
Right. And so everything right now in Tahrir Square, they're shooting people again in Egypt. And the Egyptian state-owned media, which is owned by the military, which basically runs that country and will continue to run that country after the elections next week, is saying they're actually running footage of some of the more violent police tactics here in the United States against the Occupy movement, and saying, you know, we're not doing anything different than the Americans are doing. Talk to me for a minute about the police response to the Occupy movement.
Well, of course, in many places it's been quite mean-spirited, quite violent against demonstrators. There's been a few examples where police have, in fact, backed off. In Albany, New York, earlier on, some of the police establishment basically told the governor and the mayor of Albany that, you know, these are peaceful protesters. We don't need to do this.
Right.
But they were since overruled and have, in fact, been arresting people. So it's been quite awful. The interesting thing is that the worse they are, the more support the movement gets. I mean, those images of those young people in Berkeley being pepper sprayed while they're sitting peacefully on the ground, or that elderly woman here in Seattle who was pepper sprayed for peacefully protesting, those things are not helping the efforts to shut this movement down. In fact, they're just feeding the outrage.
And what direction do you see this moving?
Well, it's certainly evolving very quickly. I mean, if you think about just 2 months ago, this whole thing started. It erupted all over the country, you know, Occupy sites all over in both big cities and small towns. Now, of course, the weather's getting harsh and very difficult to spend all your time outside. And of course, having these encampments have their own issues that come up. So I think the movement is rapidly evolving. And I think what we're going to see is a lot of different creative kinds of responses. Some people are going to be going to help prevent evictions. They're going to be standing in front of homes like they were recently in Cleveland, Ohio, where they actually helped to keep a woman and her two children from being evicted for at least giving them another 30 days. I think they're going to be going into courtrooms where people are trying, you know, where there's eviction processes in the works. I think they're going to be occupying empty buildings, as we've already seen in Oakland. And I think they're going to be doing something else, which is somewhat what happened in Spain. At least there's discussion about the ways in which you can take territory, and it doesn't have to be staying 24/7 there. You don't have to be camping out all the time. But you can still establish territories in which a creative process can happen. These general assemblies can happen. People can discuss among themselves what kind of world they want and start creating that world in their communities and in their neighborhoods.
You know, in 2000, 2001, 2002, I forget which year it was, I was down there as it was happening in Argentina. The IMF had made all these draconian demands of that country, austerity, privatize your social security, blah, 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 or you won't get loans from us. And Argentina basically told them to take a flying leap. And they cut off the funds to Argentina, and there was a big crash, and a lot of businesses left the country. A lot of factories closed down. Business people were moving their money and sometimes their bodies out of the country. And many of the middle-class workers in these factories occupied the factories and kept them running and continued making goods. And now, here a decade later, They have formed workers' cooperatives, and they own the factories. They were able to buy the Meta, you know, for a song from the original owners, or in some cases the state simply sanctioned giving them to them. New forms of new laws, new incorporation laws were created and put on the books. In the United States, there's only, I think, 23 states that allow for worker-owned cooperatives. It's legal everywhere in Argentina now, and it's spreading all across South America. The largest, of course, is Mondragon out of Spain. It's, you know, worldwide, $16 billion a year, I believe, enterprise, you know, well over 10,000 employees. Do you envision this moving in that direction, that the Occupy movement could end up being part of the woof and weave of the economic fabric of this country, or do you see it more as the kind of the old SDS or the civil rights movement, where it does its thing and it establishes some new benchmarks, accomplishes some things, and then gets out of the way and people step into that, the space created?
Well, I think there's really no telling what will happen. It's so huge, but I think all of the above are likely to happen because it's so diffuse and so diverse, and there's so many different manifestations of it. So I do think there, just in my own community, there are people who are now very excited about a local currency, local barter system, because so many people are out of work.
Mm-hmm.
That gives people an opportunity to still offer what they have to offer, their time and their skills, and to get things that they need in return. So I know that that's happening. I think the fact that so many people were moving their money is the first stage of building some of those new economic alternatives. Now there's so many more people who are members of their credit union. Some of them may run for the board or ask their board of this institution that they own, you know, how about if you invest in these kinds of local enterprises? How about if you support, you know, green enterprises? How about if you do things that help create jobs in our own community? So we're starting to see the beginnings of that, that sort of stepping up and saying, we want to have some kind of say in what happens in our economy. We're really tired of this Wall Street system where all of our money from, you know, banking at our local bank just goes right up to Wall Street where it gets used in the, the global casino. What if we used our money instead to build the real economy that provides real goods and services? And I think worker cooperatives is certainly part of that picture potentially,
you know,
as well.
You know, if you look at American history, 1934, the great Flint sit-down strike was the, you know, occupy the factories, and that led to the Wagner Act of 1935 and the National Labor Relations Act and 40, 50 years of strong unionization. It seems, my guess is that the next wave of occupy the factories is going to be worker-owned cooperatives. I mean, you know, we'll see where this goes, but maybe it'll be the return of the unionization. Certainly the unions are on board with the Occupy movement, it seems, to a large extent. Mary Kay, forgetting her last name, but Henry, Mary Kay Henry, the president of SEIU, was arrested last weekend as part of the Occupy movement out in New York. So, anyhow,
yeah,
I
think that's right, and it's been very, very helpful part of the movement. They haven't been trying to take over the movement. They've been cooperating with it.
There you go. Sarah Van Gelder, the book is This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, a full Monty that involves being naked and Santa Claus.
Ho, ho, ho!
Oh, no. Revitalizing the democracy, occupying the airwaves. Tom Hartman here with you. Ooh, that's our full Monty alert music. Let's see. Oh, only in San Francisco. Next month, the Guinness Book of World Records will be on hand in the Bay City to officiate what could be the world's largest gathering of naked Santa Clauses. To commemorate the 10th anniversary of SantaCon, an event in San Francisco in which people dress up like Saint Nick, get drunk, and commit blatant acts of debauchery around the city, hundreds are expected to turn out in their Santa hats and boots and nothing else. Luckily, in San Francisco, there are no laws against public nudity, and Guinness will be very strictly officiating the record-breaking attempt. All participants must be wearing a Santa hat, perhaps boots, gloves, and a beard, but absolutely nothing else. Elves and reindeer costumes are not allowed either, and most importantly, don't confuse the jingle bells with the jingle balls.
Ho, ho, ho!
Yeah. I really had to read that. Okay. Rick Santorum, speaking of clip number eight, Jacob, speaking of what's going to bring down America, is it going to be, I know in advance what he would think of the naked Santa Clauses given this.
But we have to fight the battles in the states. We cannot defer. We can't say the 10th Amendment. They can do what they want. This is too important for that. It is a basic and central value. The family is the bedrock of our society. Unless we protect it with the institution of marriage, our country will fall.
And this is his argument for why we need a federal law making gay marriage against the law. Deal with what the states want. Rick Santorum, he's such a federalist. He's such a small government guy. Except when it comes to what you're doing in your bedroom. Then he's all about the government. Rick Perry, I was talking with Victoria Jones about the military and how basically the military in Egypt is Egypt. I mean, it's Egyptian industry. The army owns the weapons manufacturing facilities. They own the bottled water facilities. They own a lot of the retail. They own probably... Well, I don't know the percentage. My understanding is it's well over 50% of the entire economy of Egypt is owned by the military, which is one of the reasons that they don't want to let go of it. They don't want to turn it over to civilian control. This is why Thomas Jefferson fought so hard for there to be an amendment to the Constitution, the Second Amendment, to say that there shall be no standing army during times of peace. But instead that every man 17 to 47 years of age and in good health shall be a member of a citizen's militia. And that a well-ordered militia, in order to maintain the integrity of a free state, Congress shall not pass laws forbidding the right to bear arms. Right? This was the amendment that he wanted. He and many other of the founders. And by just a couple of votes, they were not able to get the whole thing into the Constitution, so they got a fragment of it in there. But they wanted to make sure that not only did we not have an army during times of peace, but that even during times of war, that army was 100% under the control of people answerable to the citizens, to we the people, answerable to the president who's elected, answerable to Congress through an act of war resolution, which is or legislation, which is the Congress is elected, the House of Representatives elected. Every single member of the House of Representatives is up for election every 2 years, every single member of the Senate every 6 years, and the president every 4 years, that those were the only people who could make military decisions in the United States. The military would execute those decisions, but the foundational decisions would be in the hands of civilians so that you don't end up with a situation like Egypt has right now. Now, you and I know how common sense this is. And anybody who knows anything about the history of this country or ever bothered to read Thomas Jefferson's letters to James Madison in 1787 when Jefferson was in Paris as our envoy to Paris, our ambassador to France, And Madison was literally writing the Constitution of the United States, and read those letters and his and not just his letters to Madison. I mean, he was writing them to anybody who would hear about how important it was not to have a military, or who knows the history of the Jefferson presidency. When he came into office, there were either 300,000 or 600,000 people in the military. My recollection is it was over 300,000. And when he left, it was about 6,000. He basically wiped out the military while he was president because he did not believe we should have a standing army during times of peace. But Rick Perry? Rick Perry don't know jack. Clip number nine.
Don't let some congressman sitting in an air-conditioned office in Washington, D.C. deciding what the rules of engagement are. Let those war fighters win the war. Let them come home victorious. That's what the American military man and woman's all about. And for us to micromanage them in a civilian way, without their commanders truly being in charge, is absolutely irresponsible, and as the commander-in-chief of this country, I will not let it happen.
So the Constitution says that the President of the United States, the civilian, is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States. But Rick Perry says if he's elected president, he will not let that happen. He will not tell the military what to do. Please tell me this is not insane. Why is this not a headline? Why is there not like screaming? Why are people not going nuts about this? Wait a minute. Rick Perry wants us to have a military like Egypt's, where they're not answerable to the civilian control, they're not answerable to the voters, they simply do whatever they want, they end up owning half the country. They can shoot at people and no elected officer can say, no, you can't, because they're not in charge. The military's in charge. Somebody needs to sit Rick Perry down in front of a computer and play some old video that's on YouTube of Dwight Eisenhower warning about the power, the misplaced power in the hands of the military-industrial complex and how dangerous to liberty it would be. It blows my mind. It's like Paul Krugman came out on Sunday and said, you know, only fools and clowns would be promoting the Republican agenda. Which is Rick Perry? I think he's both.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, your calls and the good, the bad, and the radiolucently ugly. Wow, what a great word. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very radiolucently ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good, Congressman Ted Deutsch. While some of his colleagues on Capitol Hill ran as far away from the Occupy movement as possible, the Democratic congressman from Florida is embracing it. As a member of the House Judiciary Committee, Congressman Deutsch introduced the Occupy Amendment, an acronym for outlawing corporate cash, undermining the public interest in our elections and democracy. The amendment would overturn the Supreme Court Citizens United decision and ban poor for-profit companies, corporations, from meddling in our politics. In a statement, Congressman Deutsch said, Americans of all stripes agree that for far too long, corporations have occupied Washington and drowned out the voices of the people. It is time to return the nation's capital and our democracy to our people. Good work. We need to take it a step further and end corporate personhood as well. The bad. Rick Perry. Governor Goodhair doesn't seem to understand one of the foremost accomplishments of the American system of government, that is, that our military is controlled by representatives of we the people. During the Iowa Family Leadership Forum over the weekend, Rick Perry blasted the idea of civilian control of the military. Perry said, we shouldn't let some congressman sitting in an air-conditioned office in Washington, D.C. decide what the rules of engagement are. And for us to micromanage them in a civilian way without their commanders truly in charge is absolutely irresponsible. And as commander-in-chief of this country, I'll not let it happen. Right. In Egypt right now, we're learning what happens when civilians don't control the military. Or you've seen it in Burma for the last 20 years. More than 20 people in Egypt have been killed in the streets in protests against the military and that country's grip on power. And Rick Perry wants to bring that sort of military control to the United States. And the very, very ugly, who else but Congressman Joe Walsh. The Tea Party favorite, also known as the deadbeat dad congressman who owes more than $100,000 in child support, went on the attack against military veterans over the weekend. At a town hall meeting on Saturday, Walsh called Occupy Wall Street patriots spoiled and pampered and argued that they are, quote, advocating anti-American solutions, end quote. When pressed on what he thought about all the military veterans who've joined the movement, Walsh said, they don't understand this country and they are pushing socialist solutions. Of all the things to call our nation's military veterans, socialists who don't understand this country is at the top of the list for Congressman Joe Walsh. And I don't think he can chalk this gaffe up to too much coffee. It's just very, very ugly. Well, actually, you know, when you think about it, the military is the most socialist of all the institutions we have in the United States. They provide free health care, free housing, free clothing, free food, free transportation, a pension, free education. In order to join the military, you pretty much have to be a socialist. I mean, you're signing up for pure socialism. The U.S. military is socialism in the United States. In fact, they even have a law that says, or a rule, I don't know if it's a law or a rule, but that says that the most highly paid general can't bank more than, used to be 20 times, I think it might be 30 times now, than the most lowly paid private. There is a standard for the maximum ratio between PFC and five-star general. So, the most socialist of all our institutions, the military, and yet the Republicans, they want as many of them as they can get in every single photo op, and you know, on and on it goes. So, anyhow, some of your calls, Lawrence in Berkeley. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I'm really glad that you're talking about what next for the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. And I think what next is that the Occupy movement has to go out to the people, has to all become community organizers, or not all, but those who can. Because we've already announced to the entire country that we're there. Everybody knows that we're there. Everybody knows the issues. And now is the time to get out of the camps and go to the neighborhoods, go to the workplaces, go to the schools. Well, that's already happening. And to the banks, and
ultimately, to occupy the government.
Before you can occupy the government, you first have to occupy the people.
Yeah.
You know, you have to occupy where everybody is.
Right.
And I've just written a questionnaire, very simple, that simply says, where do you want to work? Where do you want to do your work? In your neighborhood, the workplace, your school, in the streets, in
right.
banks, elections.
Yeah. Pick one and occupy something. Well done and well said, Lawrence. Thank you very much for that. Excellent. Anthony in Chicago. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Hey, Tom, what's going on? I just want to make a quick comment about the last caller, and I do think that the Occupy movement should move off of Wall Street and actually into occupying the local rungs of government, the lowest rungs of government, possibly school.
Don't you think we can walk and chew gum at the same time?
I'm sorry?
Don't you think we can walk and chew gum at the same time, that some people can continue to occupy?
I think that's doable.
Yeah.
But my question was about socialized health care, and I'm just curious about what's going to happen to, the insurance companies invest very large amounts of money into state and local bonds, which, you know, fund construction projects, buildings, and schools, and they also employ a very large amount of American citizens. What's going to happen to all those people who are currently employed in the healthcare, health insurance industry, once insurance is actually universalized? And
right.
what's going to happen to the source of all those premiums that we pay, which are in turn invested into local bonds?
Well, first of all, 10, 20, 30, 40% of the premiums that you pay are going to salaries for CEOs, to stockholder dividends. United Healthcare alone has more than 100 people who make more than $1 million a year. So that skimming off the top is going to stop, which means that healthcare as a percentage of our GDP is going to be reduced, which means that the government can do more, more useful things like rebuild our schools with that money. And secondly, with regard to, who loses their job, most of the people who would lose their jobs would be the people who are the claims processors and the claims rejectors, the people who sit all day long looking through your medical history for some excuse. Oh, you had acne when you were 17 and you took a drug for it. Therefore, we're not going to cover your cancer diagnosis because that drug is known to make you at risk for cancer, and you never disclosed it back 20 years ago when you first got your policy with our company. Those people, I would submit to you, probably hate their jobs anyway. And the question of what happens to them is not dissimilar to what happened to the buggy whip manufacturers when Henry Ford started making cars. Progress moves along. Countries change. Economies are dynamic. New industries emerge. Nobody would have imagined 20 years ago that somebody would be out there selling, software for iPhones or developing iPad, apps. There will be opportunities if we can come up with some rational trade policies that bring our jobs home, and we can have an economy, where we've got a functional intellectual and physical infrastructure that makes it possible for business to work in this country. So that would be my answer to your question. John in Ashfield, Mass. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was watching Chris Hedges. I think it was on Free Speech TV the other night. It's one of his recorded shows,
Yeah, I interviewed him about 6 months ago, and we replayed that Friday night because I had a gig I had to go to.
Okay, this was when he was at a podium.
Oh, okay.
But
I didn't.
Maybe he did mention this with you, but he said this great thing. He said, you know, in relationship to how, you know, we're always battling Republicans, but we say, oh, look, they're regular people. They're human. They have their right to the way they think and all this other stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. He said along those lines, he says, we've been taught to tolerate the intolerant. I thought that was
the
really
to tolerate the intolerant or to tolerate the intolerable.
Yeah, to tolerate the intolerant. So we've been taught, we have, that we should, you know, put up with these people who don't put up with anything.
Oh, I get it. I get it. Yeah. You yeah.
Know, and just always down on everything.
Yeah. And that is a meme that's worthy of crushing. I'm with you, John. Excellent. Thank you for sharing that. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment on Newt Gingrich's comment about child labor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hypocrisy is just rife in the Republican Party. And several years ago, I had heard in a lecture by William Grider, who writes for The Nation and used to, you know, write for The Washington Post, say mm-hmm. that members of the Bush administration would like to see the country go back to the Gilded Age before, you know, when we had child labor, and maybe, you know, maybe they should even take it back further to the Victorian age where, you know, we had child labor and workhouses and these sorts of things. I mean, these people, they're hypocrites because they never themselves had to experience any of that. And why you would want to reverse years and years of progressive policy back to a time, you know, when, you know, the rest of the world is trying to move away from that.
Right.
I mean, it just blows your mind. It's just,
well, and you know, sort of like, you know, middle class Newt getting a free public education,
yeah,
and then marrying his high school teacher, but it was a free education, and then saying, oh, well, if kids want an education, they should work as the janitors instead of doing their homework,
right,
is not that dissimilar from Newt the draft dodger saying, hey, let's go to war.
Right.
Or Dick Cheney, the draft dodger, saying, hey, let's go to war.
Right. And, you know, people, economists that, you know, propose these, you know, draconian measures and they want to bring us back, you know, to a totally laissez-faire type of system. I have news for them. Maybe what we should do is outsource their jobs. After all, they're redundant. They made
there you go.
Mistake,
so, there you know? You go. Well said, John. Thank you very much. Economic chicken hawks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This new survey by Wells Fargo. Three quarters of us? Well, I'll tell you about it later.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
So I mentioned Wells Fargo Bank. They actually did, you know, they have economists there, and they do these surveys of what's going on because they got to figure out what they're going to do with their money and how they're going to react to the marketplace and things. Three quarters of senior citizens, and I'm not sure how they define that. I'm assuming people over 65. Three quarters of senior citizens in the United States who earn less than $100,000 say they need to work well into their retirement years to keep afloat. One quarter said that they must work until they are 80. Wow. I mean, that's where we're at in the United States now? It's bizarre. Preston in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Hey, Preston, what's on your mind today?
Okay, first of all, I'm going to say that we donate to free speech, and everybody should, because if they're watching it, they can afford a couple bucks. If me and Marianne can, anybody can.
Okay, thank you.
What I'd like to mention is that this Occupy, you know, the parks and this and that, this is not really a fad or anything. This is a symptom of what's wrong with the country. No jobs. You can't go to the doctor when you're sick. This is just sort of the tip of the iceberg. Now, for the last 20 or 30 years, we have been slowly, this country has been slowly and methodically plundered, jobs sent overseas, slave labor, world economy, and now we're in the position we're at. We've had economic and financial collapse. Now we're seeing the political chaos. And you're starting to see just the very beginning of civil unrest. When you can't go to the doctor, when you can't feed your kids, people are not going to stand around while their kids go hungry.
Yeah.
And basically, that's in a nutshell. And
yeah,
these guys don't get it.
No, you, Preston.
They have a feeling of entitlement. The average person, they used to call it flyover country. You know, we're just the peasants, the serfs.
Yeah.
And it's not going to work.
Preston, I think you've nailed it absolutely. And there, I would say the Tea Party is a symptom as well. And thank you for the call. We are seeing populist movements where people are rising up and they're saying enough already. You know, enough. I want my country back. I want things to work. Mike in Queens, New York. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, love your show.
Thanks.
It's a quick question here. You know, on down south, the Republicans are pushing how the fetus is a person.
Yeah.
Now, if they do get that in the state, let's say, now, wouldn't it be that corporations, since they were not a fetus, cannot be considered a person?
No, unfortunately, there's no connection between the two. They're using different definitions of personhood.
Oh, okay. I was just thought maybe that, you know, they can, you know, we can use that as a... you know, a jumping off point to go after, you know, the corporation.
No, unfortunately, there's to the best of my knowledge, there's no way to do that. But it, you know, and they're, by the way, that group that is trying to make fetuses person, not even fetuses, they're trying to make the zygotes, you know, fertilized eggs that aren't even implanted in the womb, you know, that might be in a petri dish, make them have full constitutional rights and you know, that a woman must carry that to term, whether she was raped, whether, you know, whatever. Even if it's an ectopic pregnancy and it'll kill her if it continues to grow in her, it cannot be taken out. Those people are reformulating their techniques. There's a good article about it over at thinkprogress.org today. And they're going to be back with a vengeance. It's incredible. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I wish it was that simple. I really do. We need a constitutional amendment. Go to movetoamend.org for information on that. John in Portland. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Just with Grover Norquist looming so large in the public debate.
Yeah, I saw Grover the other night, actually.
Yeah, I just don't understand why Democrats, this might seem obscure to people, but you know, when Obama was running for the presidency, they accused him of palling around with terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could really say that of Grover Norquist. And, you know, there's things you can look at in the public record, like Operation Green Quest, for instance. And you can see Samuel Arion would be one person I'd throw out there. And so I just think if we could get more forceful in attacking this guy, because I really think he's nefarious.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. I don't, you know, I've had Grover on. I've debated him before. I don't, at that level of detail in his personal biography, I can't speak to it, John. I don't know, but I, you know, may well be. Ray in San Francisco. Hey, Ray. Thanks for waiting so long.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
I wanted to tell you about UC Davis people. I worked for Army Bera out in Sacramento, and we made more phone calls and went to more doors, and it was all UC Davis people.
Yeah.
And so this didn't come out of some kind of, you know, this has been going on.
And the context for this, by the way, is that it was at UC Davis where these kids were sitting on the ground and they got pepper sprayed.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right. I work with these kids. I've never seen so many kids work so hard. Dr. Army Bera was a UC dean, and they came out to work for him, and we almost had Lundgren. Just before, well, 2 weeks before the election, Crossroads came in with about $600,000 to say Army Bera was a terrorist.
That's GPS Cross. You mean Carl Rove's 527?
Crossroads. They also came in against Sherry McNerney and another one just 2 weeks before the election.
Yeah.
And we still almost had Lundgren. I think we lost by 7 points.
Yeah.
And Army Bera is going to run again. And believe me, these kids will be helping Army Bera. And this time I think we have a good chance of taking down Lundgren. But these kids are really solid. And I just can't tell you how much the joy I have working with these guys.
Well, I was so impressed to see nobody jump up and try and punch that cop or knock the can out of his hand. Nobody. They sat there and they took it just like the protesters did in the early 60s and the late 50s here in the United States.
These guys are smart. They know Gandhi. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They know that any kind of violence will just destroy their movement.
Yes.
And that's what you got. That's what you saw. And hopefully that will be the iconic moment that turns enough people. Remember, it's that group that we worried about in 2008 about coming out to vote.
Yeah. No, I think the 20 years from now, we're going to be looking back at that video, Aunt Ray, and saying that was the moment. Thank you for the call. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, Jesse Ventura versus the TSA. What really happened? We'll get the real story right from the horse's mouth, as they say, when Governor Ventura drops by. Plus, why JFK's murder still matters. I'm going to talk with JFK historian, co-author with me of Legacy of Secrecy, and we have some exciting news to share also that has to do with Robert De Niro. And the best of the rest of your call of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, tag, you're it, occupy something.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.